You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast episode 32. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today we're kicking off a new project that Social Europe runs together with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung and the Hans Böckler Stiftung, and we're going to investigate the crisis of globalization. I'm thrilled to say that the first interview partner in this series is going to be Danny Roderick of the Kennedy School at Harvard University, and Danny and I are going to have a chat about the crisis of globalization and how it relates to populism and possibly the crisis of democracy. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So, Danny Roderick, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about the crisis of globalization. And in order to get us going, what do you think actually is the crisis of globalization, and how did it come about?
Well, I mean, the crisis, I guess, is the result of a lot of people not being particularly happy about the way that globalization has gone. I think it's rooted in the highly asymmetric effects that globalization has had in societies around the world, particularly the advanced democracies, which have seen their underlying social contracts dissolve as a result, not just of globalization, but globalization is an important part of it, of changes really since the 1980s. And the asymmetry is basically has driven both economic inequality and also greater social distance. And I emphasize both the economic and social aspects of this phenomenon. That greater separation between groups that see themselves as beneficiaries of globalization because their networks are global, they're mobile, they have the resources and the skills to take advantage of global markets, and other groups who view themselves as sort of much more tied in with their local communities, much more dependent on the local economy, and without the skills and networks and resources to take advantage of global economy. And I think this shows up in many places, particularly where social insurance is weak, in greater inequality between the winners and losers. But even when it doesn't show up as greater inequality in economic terms, it's almost always shows up as greater social distance between these two groups in terms of divergence in values, in norms, divergence in terms of sort of the cognitive maps of these two groups in terms of how they explain the world to themselves and what they think of the other group.
And where do you think does especially that social distance come from? I mean, is it maybe also result from the upward social mobility of the previous generation that you have sort of a new mixture of these social strata that now seem to struggle to understand each other?
I think it is rooted both in material structural factors that that we have differences in levels of wealth and education and skills across different strata, and it's also rooted in a kind of the development of a new kind of narrative about how the world works and a new understanding of economics and the relationship between the market and society or the market and the state, which really comes out of the failure of the post-war Keynesian or the perceived failure of the post-war Keynesian intellectual framework as a result of the crisis of the 1970s, as a perceived crisis of the welfare state, And I think sort of what has happened is that, you know, the intellectual elite have converged around sort of a kind of a much more market fundamentalist or if you will, neoliberal view of the role of markets in society, with, you know, the difference between the right and the left of this elite, you know, being essentially limited to, you know, whether you want more sweeteners at the margin or less, whether you want more, you know, transfers and more social insurance or less, but a fundamental agreement on a significant role of the market and reduction in the role of the government and social entitlements in general.
And do you also see a political dimension to this crisis of globalization? I think it was Mark Blyth who said that, you know, if a political economy operates in the way that, at least on a relative level, large parts of society feel disadvantaged at some point, that it's not really surprising. It doesn't take a genius to predict some sort of political crisis as well.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, the you know, politics is both at the root of the crisis in some sense, but also, you know, is affected by these developments and the deepening of these economic and social cleavages. I mean, it's at the root of this, of course, to the extent that these structural trends and the kind of ideological transformation that I just described, you know, induced political elites to engage in a set of you know, new global arrangements. So we have the kind of globalization model we have followed since the 1990s. As a result, has been essentially a very, very different model than the, you know, pre-1990 model. I think the concrete expressions of that are the formation of the World Trade Organization, which was a much more ambitious undertaking, reaching much more behind the border in terms of domestic regulations and domestic measures on everything from intellectual property to subsidies and investment measures. And on the one side, the other side, of course, you know, the deepening of financial globalization, which, you know, to which I think, again, the 1990s is a kind of a watershed when we, financial globalization or the opening up of capital flows became the norm rather than the exception. And I think, you know, both sort of the new WTO model of trade and the, you know, financial globalization model of finance were very sharp departures that, you know, didn't fall on our laps from the sky. It was actually, you know, political decisions by governments of the center-right or the center-left, in fact, often of the center-left, to rewrite the rules or deepen globalization in a particular direction. I think sort of many of the consequences of these in terms of the, you know, the division, the deepening of the economic and social cleavages were, of course, a result of this new model of globalization. And then, of course, you know, then there's always a political response to these divisions. So I think the kind of, you know, populism we're seeing together today is to an important extent driven by these cleavages and the, you know, the distrust and the distance vis-a-vis elites that has been created and the inability of the, you know, centrist mainstream political parties, which are deeply implicated in this process, to really provide an adequate response, and therefore opening up of the political space of, you know, mostly parties on the sort of, you know, far right or, you know, nativist groups that we call sort of this populist backlash. But so that's then in turn becomes the, you know, we come back fully and then sort of it's a political response to it.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I mean, in the discussion, especially about this populist backlash, you often hear that in addition to some of the structural and socioeconomic factors that you also mentioned, that there is a cultural dimension at which the backlash is taking place. Do you see that also, that there's a sort of cultural backlash against globalization, the extent to which that, you know, the cultural intermingling has gone too far in just the view of many people, even amongst those who might not be economically disadvantaged as a result of it?
Yeah, Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, there are always latent, you know, group differences, and they can be expressed more or less depending on the context and depending on what is being rendered salient. My view is that you know, the underlying shocks of the last two or three decades, in other words, what has made the difference, has been mostly of an economic nature, and are rooted in you know, economic anxieties and in economic inequality, and the accompanying sort of differences in the social status and perceived social status of different groups vis-a-vis the elites, vis-a-vis the world economy in general. Now, but then, you know, in the political sphere, these anxieties and these divisions can be expressed in a number of different ways. And I think what political institutions and what political systems do is essentially provide a, you know, a supply of political entrepreneurs and political groups that are providing various framings, various explanations of, you know, what the source of the problem is and therefore what the remedy is going to be. I think, you know, what is striking in the last, in recent years, and one thing that I had not really foreseen, is how successful the right has been, how successful the right-wing populists have been in terms of being able to provide a cultural framing, a cultural narrative, an ethno-nationalist narrative, to provide an explanation of what is going on. So if you're suffering, you know, it's because the rules of the game have favored disproportionately, you know, minorities or immigrants, and you know, your problems, you know, have not been taken care of, and it's a way of framing the problems in a kind of cultural or nativist kind of a way. You know, one can also frame these things in a, you know, in a kind of a more traditional leftist social class kind of terms, that the problem really lies with the rules that large corporations, financial institutions, and wealthy have imposed, and that therefore the remedy is not in you know, ethno-nationalism and kicking the foreigners out. The remedy is simply pursuing more inclusive policies. So that, you know, emphasizes a very different kind of struggle, very different policy agenda. You know, there are some left-wing populists around, but I think mostly what gets our attention are the right-wing nativists. So get back to the question you asked, I mean, clearly there is a very strong cultural element in what we're seeing, but you know, I don't see the cultural element as the deep cause here. Not to underemphasize the importance of racism in the United States or you know, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, but I think these are sort of always there somewhere, you know, below the surface, and you know, we cannot explain a change with a constant. And I think what has changed much more visibly is the economic context.
I mean, quite interestingly, also related to this is that even though, as you rightly mentioned, these developments have been the result of political decisions taken in the 1990s, or some of them earlier, many people seem to perceive that, you know, that has unleashed a beast that is now out of control. The idea that politics is no longer in control and cannot affect positive change or change in any shape or form is very damaging, because that seems to strengthen tendencies to go for autocratic leaders, be it in the United States or elsewhere. I mean, how do you see these political levers? Are they still there? I mean, before we get to the sort of the policies that would be conducive to shaping globalization going forward, do you still think that politics in general still has the power to affect that kind of change?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think it's a myth that, you know, technological changes, you know, improvements in communication and all of that essentially, you know, have undercut the power of the nation state or the ability of politicians to do anything to such an extent that, you know, we are really powerless against these trends. I think this was basically the line that, you know, more or less the center-left took, you know, from the 1990s onward. You know, this was, you know, sort of the line of Tony Blair, you know, that you know, we, you know, globalization is upon us and you know, the best that we can do is just adjust. And anybody who's saying that, you know, sort of, you know, the winds of change can be resisted, you know, doesn't know what they're talking about. I think this is completely wrong. I mean, I think, as I was saying before, you know, these rules of globalization are, you know, are heavily dependent on the choices that elites made. Financial globalization runs on a financial system that's underpinned by financial regulations and sort of legal and regulatory arrangements that are for the most part maintained by the nation state. When things go bad and wrong in finance, the first thing that happens is banks go, you know, to their governments for help. And without those governments, you know, for example, the last financial crisis, the effects would have been many, many times worse. And of course, the rules of globalization, and in particular, the particular direction that we have gone in globalization, privileging pharmaceutical companies or multinational corporations, let's say, over labor or consumer groups, is a very deliberate choice, and it's not something that, you know, cannot be altered or corrected or rebalanced. I think there has been a political interest in spreading this myth of powerlessness, because often, of course, you know, businesses want to tell governments that, look, you know. You can't do anything. You have to reduce regulations and our taxes because we're competing in a global economy, and you know, we have to compete with low taxes and the regulations elsewhere, and otherwise we'll go. And oddly enough, I think, you know, many governments, as I was saying, including central left governments, have hid behind globalization. It's basically saying, look, we have no choice. We have to do this. And I think that the language around globalization has been really, you know, in some ways has magnified the globalization backlash over time, because it wasn't just the right who kept saying, look, we need to reduce taxes, we need to reduce regulation so that we can compete in the global economy. You know, all the things that the left wanted to say, they were being motivated by the needs of globalization too. So the left was saying, we need to invest in infrastructure, we need to invest in education, because that's what we need to do to compete in the global economy. It seemed, you know, whether you took the right variant or the left variant, it seemed that, you know, globalization was this thing that was driving what is it that we have to do, as opposed to globalization in principle, or to, you know, being a means to what is it that we want to do. So it's not an end. And because it was taken as this thing that was, you know, cannot be changed, and that to which we're all subject. Essentially, you know, we've aggravated in ordinary people's minds, you know, the pressures or the ills that globalization brings, and we've completely underestimated the degree to which it still is under our own control.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. I think the then Chancellor Gerhard Schröder put it all in that one sentence when he said, either we're reforming or we're being reformed. So it's just that whole notion that you have to adjust domestically to whatever is out there that is exogenously created and you can't do anything about it. So where do you see these political levers? Are they still at a nation state? Are they on a supranational level, or is it necessarily a combination of both?
No, I think it's mostly in the nation state. I mean, I think even in those areas where the pressures of globalization and international immobile capital and finance are very strong, such as, you know, the race to the bottom in corporate taxation, for example, even there, The nation state has a significant amount of room. For example, you know, you don't have to negotiate with other countries to impose, you know, to change your tax regime on a basis of sales in a particular jurisdiction. So you can tax, for example, corporations in proportion to their sales that they undertake in your own jurisdiction. And therefore, you know, the location of the corporation and its subsidiaries is no longer an issue. And so there are, you know, even in that area where, you know, the pressures from globalization are actually fairly strong, and where we do see the downward race to the bottom in terms of reduction in corporate taxes, you know, it's largely the fact that we are unable to tax corporations is largely a deliberate choice rather than inability or you know, lack of imagination on our part. And of course, in many other areas, I think, you know, it's even more so. So I think, you know, the United States has still significant room for increasing its or improving its social insurance policies. And nothing in globalization prevents the United States from, you know, having, you know, health insurance for everybody, for having health insurance be completely portable, for having, you know, active labor market policies or unemployment insurances or, you know, a minimum wage that pays a decent living wage for everybody. You know, similarly, with respect to a lot of other things that would increase jobs and living standards, like, you know, the United States could do with a significant ramping up of spending on infrastructure. You know, the United States could expand on, you know, a lot of things that it already does under the radar screen of in terms of industrial policies and restructuring policies. And so there's a lot more that could be done with those. And certainly, you know, there's a lot more room for progressivity in income taxes and in introducing wealth taxes before you get into the problem of, you know, skilled and wealthy people, you know, running away to the Cayman Islands. I mean, so there is, you know, I think most of the agenda really has to be at the national level. And I do think that, you know, there are things to fix in our trade agreements and the WTO as well, but I think in some sense that's sort of that's not, you know, the first priority.
Okay, and you know, if you put yourself into the shoes of policymakers now, if you were now tasked with sort of okay reforming globalization and put it on a more sustainable footing, what would be your agenda? What would be your top priorities?
With respect to globalization per se, you know, I think, you know, the way that I see the main line of reform, I would express it as essentially a kind of a rebalancing of globalization. I don't like posing the problem in terms of a, you know, kind of reversal in globalization. So I don't think the issue is really being, you know, slowing down or reversing or going back on globalization. So I think, you know, once you put the debate in terms of pro versus anti-globalization, I think you miss where the real issues are. You know, the problem with our existing model isn't that, you know, we have too much globalization. The problem is that we have too much of a globalization of the kind that particular interest groups have been successful at getting, while other interests have been left out. So we have a globalization that disproportionately privileges multinational corporations, pharmaceutical companies, financial institutions, high-tech companies, and labor and environmental groups and many consumer groups just feel left out. So I think, you know, the issue is really rebalancing. What does that mean? I mean, it means, you know, paying a lot more attention to the kinds of issues that labor cares about and paying a little bit less attention to the issues that capital cares about. So, you know, I think we should take, for example, you know, the ISDS, investor rights in trade agreements. You know, it's an abomination. You know, it should not be there, and I think this is, you know, it should be taken out. I think we should, you know, sort of have gone way too far in terms of, you know, intellectual property rights protectionism. and by, this is like one of the areas where corporations lobby the most when they're supporting trade agreements, because intellectual property rights protection is one of the, main benefits. But it is not properly a trade arena, and unlike, the things we ought to be discussing in trade, they essentially are redistributive from lower income countries to rich countries. And I think so, trade agreements are not the right domain for discussing that. I think we should have a lot less sort of behind the border harmonization. I think we have sort of passed the WTO, was the transition to a kind of a new model where we said, we're going to try to target all transactions costs to international trade and investment, even if those are regulations behind the border. And I think, once you're starting to go into regulations behind the border, you're really reaching into sort of deeply political territory. One company's, trade restriction is another social group's protection of jobs or health and safety standards or, embodiment of their norms with respect to how we should be treating the environment, for example. And so those are, I think, it's very, dangerous for the trade regime to start thinking about regulatory diversity in the world economy as a trade barrier.
Everything is a non-tariff trade barrier by definition.
Becomes a non-tariff barrier. So I think those are all areas where I think we should be doing a lot less of. There are areas that, where globalization or global governance hasn't gone far enough. And I think, there are areas where we should work a lot more on. I think, corporate tax harmonization and much greater transparency in global banking is one such area. So international coordination of corporate tax policies and much greater exchange of bank and other related information for tax purposes. That's an area where there are sort of still big gains from improving global rules. And another area is probably the area where it's the greatest gains from globalization to be had that we have not explored sufficiently is a global regime for temporary labor mobility in goods and capital. Global markets are already fairly free, so we're really trying to eke out very tiny efficiency gains from further reductions in barriers, or at least border barriers. Whereas in labor mobility, of course, the barriers are huge, and that's the economic gains are extremely large. But of course, that's also an area where there are potential concerns about what the distribution implications would be from having workers from low-income countries have greater access to labor markets in the advanced countries. But somewhat paradoxically, the economics of international labor mobility tells us that, in fact, if you compare the overall economic gains to the redistributive effects, they are much, much larger in the area of labor mobility than there is in, when we're negotiating barriers on, trade in goods or in financial services or capital. What that means is that we basically, have much greater ability to redistribute those gains because the net gains, the aggregate gains, are so large relative to amount to the potential redistribution that would take place. So our possibility for doing what is the kind of Pareto superior trade reforms, which is to say you reduce barriers without leaving anybody necessarily worse off by undertaking the compensations that are required. We have much greater in principle ability, potential to do that in labor markets than we do in our traditional domains for negotiation.
But that obviously then runs the danger of running against the anti-immigrant sentiments that are sweeping across.
The deep problem there is that we've never been able to separate in people's mind you know, economic mobility from immigration. And of course, there's always a concern that you know, a temporary visa program, temporary work visa program, allowing people to work for 3 to 5 years, let's say, in a host economy, necessarily will turn into an expanded immigration program. But I think we need to separate out different kinds of programs and different dimensions of people crossing borders. We need to separate the issue of refugees, which is fundamentally a human rights issue, from the issue of migration, which is fundamentally a question about, you know, how much diversity do we want, how large a population do we want, and what kind of, you know, policy are we going to follow in terms of, do we want more family reunification? Do we want more skilled immigrants? That's really, you know, sort of very much a kind of an economic, social, political discussion that every country has to sort out for itself. And third, we just have an issue of worker mobility, which is basically people coming in to work under the labor standards of the host country, but with no claims to eventual citizenship. And I think, you know, the gains from that last domain of economic labor mobility are so large that it would be really a pity if we held that domain, we kept that domain hostage to all the problems that we encounter when we talk about immigration policies. And I think that's an area where the left has to get is to be able to get over its sort of hang up of, you know, sort of that the human rights issues are so large that, you know, any temporary work visa program that did not at some level provide a kind of path to citizenship would be a fundamental violation of human rights. And I think, you know, holding, you know, applying that standard, you know, really backfires because you're preventing a lot of people in the developing countries from having, you know, like substantially increasing their economic livelihoods for themselves and for their families and for their countries back home by applying a standard that is not going to be met in practice anyhow.
And could that also be a two-way benefit? So obviously if these migrants then return after 3 to 5 years to their home countries, they would probably transfer quite significant skills and would be able to apply those in their home economies as well. So could there be a developmental aspect?
That, in fact, was a big part of, you know, I've written up a proposal along the lines in several places, but encouraging return would be a very big part of this proposal. Now, of course, people say, well, you know, it's very difficult to do that. It's true, but I think that there are a combination of incentives, both carrots and sticks, that would be worth experimenting with, and the incentives ought to apply both to the economic migrants themselves. In other words, give them an incentive to return, and you can do that by having forced saving programs that part of the incomes are held in escrow accounts and are not returned until the migrant goes back. But there also have to be sort of carrots and sticks on the home governments of the migrants. And one idea that I proposed is the idea that if each home country, each sending country has a given quota, that the renewal of the quota would be conditional, would be subject to a large enough proportion of each wave returning to the home country. Now, for a home or a sending government, that gives a very strong incentive to find ways in which to attract their economic migrants back home, because otherwise they would lose. So they would be able to send fewer people in the next wave, in the next round, and presumably lots of people are waiting in queue, and that would not be a very popular thing. So I can, you know, if you set the right incentives, I can easily see how, you know, sending governments would be competing to bring their migrants back home, and it would be nice for a change to see governments competing for their people back to bring them back home, as opposed to competing for tax and subsidies for foreign investors.
Yeah, I mean, that could be an especially important policy for Europe if you look at the sort of migration coming from Africa driven by economic despair, which is unlikely to go down naturally anytime soon. So that might be an interesting policy to look at.
Yes, I mean, this thing is going to happen, whether it happens formally or sort of, you know, kind of, you know, illegally under the radar screen. So I think it is going to happen. So I think, you know, and it's, you know, the benefits both to the, you know, the migrants themselves, but also, of course, to the, you know, to the host economies, especially in Europe with demographic change and shrinking labor force. I think, you know, that's a very potentially a very important source of, you know, sort of economic gain in the host economy, you know, with the right kind of complementary programs in place. But as you say, I mean, you know, these pressures are, you know, going to be there, and it's not going to disappear. And you know, we have a chance to regularize some of these flows. And so, you know, that countries that care about their human rights and democracy record can, you know, say with a straight face that, you know, look, you know, we're going to be tough on illegal migration, on illegal, you know, people crossing the borders illegally for economic reasons, because we already have this program that is, you know, sort of a formalized program of temporary work permits. And I think so that I think, you know, makes these countries look better.
Okay, very interesting policy idea, which we try to popularize here in Europe. I think that's all we have time for today. Danny, thank you very much for talking
to me.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.